really warm welcome to Highfield Church and to our termly Highfield Lecture with a difference. For those of you who don't normally come to Highfield, my name's Erica Roberts. I'm one of the staff team, and it's my job just to do some housekeeping and to warmly welcome you here. If you happened to need the facilities, we have the one loo over on my right at the front of church. When you come to the Highfield Lecture next term, there will be a choice of loos at the back of church. So I bet you can't wait for that. I can see no reason why there would be a fire. There are no candles lit, but if there was, just go out the way you came in, and there are several exits. We have refreshments at the back of church, and at the end of our time this evening, please do stay behind and join us for refreshments. I'm now going to hand over to Pete Williams, who is going to then introduce our guest lecturer, Paul Miller from Aberdeen. And I'd like to say lots, and this is Roy Plumley.
Indeed. Many people have been working hard over the last few weeks to bring this together. Not least, up on stage here, we have a combination of Southampton University's Chamber Choir and members of the Highfield Choir and local community who have volunteered to sort of join in as a scratch choir for this event. So let's give these guys a round of applause, first of all. They have been rehearsed and are now going to be conducted by George Richford, who can now wave at us and come on and say hello. We have an organist, our church organist, Muriel Billington, on the organ. But my castaway tonight is Welsh composer Paul Miller. So Paul is a professor of composition at the University of Aberdeen. So we flew him down here on Friday night via Manchester. He's a fellow of the Royal Society of Arts, and his albums, A Tender Light and I Saw Eternity, have both been best-selling albums. The New York Times has called Paul one of the most important composers to have emerged from Welsh choral music. And critics have described Paul's compositions as having serene beauty and as being music of deep spiritual searching. So, Paul, the first question I'd like to launch us off with this evening is how do you see the relationship between spirituality and music?
Well, I have to say, thank you, Peter. First of all, thank you for inviting me down. Peter and I met very briefly, or at least we were in the same room at the C.S. Lewis Foundation of the Stone at Westminster Abbey, and so then we met and spoke after that. And I have to say, there's no better place to be cast away than here. I've spent a few days here staying with Peter and Heather, and it's been absolutely brilliant you welcoming me into your community. I came to the service this morning at 11, and I was astounded by the wonderful testament you have to Christ. Loads of people came and spoke to me. They didn't know who I was. And I thought, that's a real testament. Thinking something and doing something are two different things. So it's wonderful, and thank you for welcoming me. So, yeah, for me, faith and music and creativity are the same thing. When I was a little boy, I was very naughty. Still reasonably naughty. And I was, with my brother, taken to a river on Anglesey. I grew up on Anglesey in North Wales. And the river is called Dimlligwy, for you Welsh speakers out there. And I rather stupidly fell in, and I couldn't swim. And I was drowning. My brother had gone off. And I, at that point, thought that I was going to die. And something amazing happened to me. I surrendered to death as a child of 9. And at that moment, I felt the most amazing warmth and feeling that I've ever felt, never since, that actually death was not a bad thing. And I was dragged out. You'll be happy to realize I'm not actually a ghost. I'm here. I was dragged out and resuscitated and brought round. And I said to my dad at that moment, I want to find out what that warmth is. And that's what led me to St. Asaph Cathedral and to the church and to speak with the dean and to join the choir. And for me, even though I thought initially I would become a priest, I think the world is glad that I didn't because I'd be terrible. But for me, music is a kind of surrogate priesthood.
Interesting. Now, I guess most people who've heard of you from the Military Wives Choir endeavour, and in particularly in 2011, your song Wherever You Are was indeed the first song to be number one in the UK singles chart and in the classical chart at the same time. The Military Wives Choir conducted by Gareth Malone and lots of television coverage about that. So I'd like to play a little snatch of that and then for you to tell us a little bit about that project and how it came about. Hopefully the technology will work for us. I was speaking to a lady in this morning's service and mentioning this piece of music to her, and she said, oh yes, the tune is still stuck in my head. That is a good sign of a good piece of music, isn't it? The tune is still stuck in your head. So how did you come to be involved with the Military Wives Choir project?
Yes, it's all a bit random, to be honest. I, for some bizarre reason, I'd been invited to Chelsea Football Club's Christmas party. I'm not a supporter of Chelsea Football Club, by the way. But I'd been dragged along to this, kicking and screaming. And anyway, when I was there, we had a couple of gin and tonics, and the dancing started. And I love dancing, all these things. And so I found myself, me and one other person, was dancing to Brown Girl in the Ring by Bronia, and that was Gareth Malone. And so I knew from that moment that we were going to be friends. And so... So we became friends and we were chatting. Anyway, not long after that, he said to me, he'd had rather too many whiskies, and he said to me, look, I wonder if you'd write me a song. And I said, well, of course, and thought nothing of it, thought he'd never contact me again. Anyway, a few weeks after, he phones me up and said, I wasn't joking about that. I'm in a real problem here. I'm doing a TV program about military wives. So a group of women who, their husbands and partners are off doing whatever they're doing in Afghanistan and so on. And there's this group of women who have no community, they have no voice, no one cares about them, no one listens to them. He said, and I want to give them a voice. And the best way, he says, I think I can do this is through a choir. So he founded these two, there are now 59 military wives choirs with thousands of people in all over the world. I get bombarded with emails and letters from people who sing this song. And so he said, would I write it? So I said, well, of course I will. But if they are to have a voice, then the words must be theirs. So what we decided to do is to get hold of all their letters and notes to their partners and back during the period of this, and with permission, of course. And they sent them to my little house on Anglesey. And this big box of thing appears. And of course, you start reading through them. And what one doesn't realize is... these are could be people's last words to each other. And they're full of great deep emotion. Even just a simple line, which may sound to us here as twee, in a deep moment when you may never see somebody again, actually becomes an important line. And actually six of the men whose lyrics I used in this died during the recording of this. And so those lyrics became incredibly important to the wives of those people. And the very first one was a bracelet that she'd written down, wherever you are, my heart will keep you safe. And I thought, well, that's what it is, because in essence, it's about seeking comfort across distance. And then Gareth said, look, I wonder if you can get a line in there to connect to the Royal British Legion. And never told me why. So I thought, all right, well, the motto of the Royal British Legion, as I'm sure many of you know, is greater love hath no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. One of the most profound lines that Jesus ever said, and they're all pretty profound, but that is incredibly profound. So I decided to set that at the very end as a counter melody over the top. Well, when I sent the song off to Gareth, he phones me up and he goes, I don't think this is going to work. He said, I don't think it's the right song. He said, but I'll try it out tonight in rehearsal and I'll let you know. So he goes off and he phones me up from the rehearsal and everybody's crying. All the women are crying their eyes out. And he said, I think we've cracked it. I said, ye of little faith. We did. And then he told me where the premiere was going to be because he didn't want to freak me out beforehand. So the premiere was going to be live at the Royal British Legion Festival of Remembrance at the Royal Albert Hall in front of 5,000 people, live on BBC One in front of the Queen. I said, I'm glad you didn't tell me that beforehand. But of course, the women didn't know. So they only found out the day before. And of course, they go out onto the stage, and I was there in the audience, and it's the first standing ovation they've ever had at the Royal British Legion Festival. Because here are a bunch of women who are not singers, they never said that they were, who have decided to get together and sing a song, which is not easy, and they did, and they pulled it off, and I was incredibly proud of them. It went on to be recorded by Decca, a 100% charity single to raise money for the Royal British Legion and for SAFA Forces Help. And we raised nearly £1 million in the first week and 556,000 copies in the first 2 days. And it became the second fastest selling single ever, second only to Candle in the Wind. And so, of course, we won a Brit. I was at the Brits, sat next to Elton John. All of this, what it's enabled to do is for the Royal British Legion and for SAFA to build two enormous houses. So people who have come back from a service who have had maybe lost a limb or been, all of this money is able to support them and has supported them for the last 6 years. So, you know, if people say music doesn't change the world, they're completely wrong. It's changed the world for those people. And it's one of the things, even though people say, oh, it's just a little tune. Well, it is, but I'm quite proud of it.
So as Paul says, let me get that working here. Oh. I first came across his work. This had passed me by, unfortunately, the military wise thing. I wasn't a viewer of that particular programme. But I came across his work at Westminster Abbey in 2013 when we had this unveiling of a memorial to C.S. Lewis, the writer in Poets' Corner. And I had the privilege of, I was actually sitting in the choir stalls, at the back of the choir stalls, when the choir sang a setting of one of C.S. Lewis's poems called Love's as Warm as Tears. And I discovered thereafter that this setting of this poem had been composed by Paul. So I'd like to play you a part of this piece of music here on this clip. Stuff, isn't it? I later edited a book called C.S. Lewis at Poets' Corner, and Paul contributed a chapter to this book, telling a story that connects that spiritual experience, that sort of near-death experience you had as a child, with then the influence that C.S. Lewis had upon you. So fill that out a little bit for us.
Yeah, I was very fortunate to be involved in that, to write that piece. That is the only setting of C.S. Lewis that's been allowed to be set to music, by the way. That the estate guards his poetry and his texts very, very powerfully, and so they should. But I've always been drawn to C.S. Lewis. I mean, there isn't a person in this room, I'm sure, who hasn't read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, or Magician's Nephew, or Voyage of the Dawn Treader, all of these wonderful, wonderful books that that show you the true face of Christianity in all sorts of different ways, without ever revealing it to you, which I think is the wonderful thing that Lewis had. And of course, for me, what I was struck by is particularly one line, you know, we search for the hidden country, and another line, we live in the shadowlands. There's always this some mystical thing that we don't quite know, where we don't quite know where it is or how to find it, but sometimes you have to just have faith. And for me, the idea of a hidden country somewhere is a bit like composing. You know, you sit down at your desk or you're searching for finding something, and you have to reach out into the unknown with a certain amount of faith. And so I was drawn always to Lewis's poetry. I'm sure many people don't know his poetry. He's more known with his apologetics and his children's stories, but the poetry is incredibly powerful. And when I was asked to do this piece, I was given three choices. And I chose this, Love's as Warm as Tears, because for a number of reasons. And when I spoke to James O'Donnell at Westminster, he goes, oh, we weren't expecting you to do that one. We thought you were going to pick one of the more easier ones. And I said, well, actually, I was drawn to it because I'm quite often drawn to the contradictions in faith. Contradiction is not the right word, and you'll be able to give me the right word because you're a philosopher. Paradox is the right word. It's a more gentle way of saying contradiction. And I love the fact that, to be first, you must be last. To live, you must die. All of these paradoxes that happen. And there's a lot of them in this poem. Love's as warm as tears isn't necessarily a paradox, but it is an interesting line, which equates pain with love, which is one of the lines that runs through C.S. Lewis's work. And so when I wanted to set this text, I wanted to get those two signs. The beauty that we find in love is only beautiful when we understand the pain that comes with it as well. Otherwise, it means nothing. You know, if you go to a service or you go to a piece of music and it's just light after light after light, you're not learning anything. You have to understand the true nature of darkness to be able to be even remotely understand what light is. C.S. Lewis talks a lot about suffering being God's megaphone for raising a deaf world and all that kind of stuff, whether you agree with it or not. It is beautiful and is important to think about. And so in this piece, there are those dark moments where you get love's as fierce as fire, and you get this crushing fire chord in the middle of it, which is a series of wrong notes, for want of a better word. So this is a reflection of those paradoxes.
I wonder if that sense of reaching out and searching for something beyond and more is something that's reflected in our third piece of music. If we could have the PowerPoint up, which when I first saw your section, I thought, oh, that's a little bit left field up against the other pieces of music that we have. But the song Bright Eyes by Art Garfunkel, which many people will know from the movie cartoon of Watership Down, the novel by Richard Adams. And this song, again, speaks very much of that sort of sense of reaching out into the unknown. Is that why you chose it?
I chose it for a number of reasons. Firstly, because I absolutely adore the book. I don't know if anyone's ever read the book, Watership Down by Richard Adams. I was very lucky enough to have met Richard Adams. He died only, I think, last year, or even this year, in fact. An incredibly brilliant writer of children's stories. If you've not read Plague Dogs by Richard Adams, then get reading it. It's phenomenal. Anybody that likes dogs, you'd be crying at the end of it. So this is a stunning book about friendship, about trust, about love, in the most profound way, through the eyes of rabbits. It's amazing. And so for me, in the little cartoon that come out, where Simon and Garfunkel do this song, written by Mike Batt, the great English writer of popular songs. It is the most perfect song. Mike was asked to write a song about death, but he didn't. He wrote a song about hope through death. You know, and in the images of the words of Bright Eyes, he touches upon how can a light that burns so brightly suddenly fade and die? And he's asking, how can that happen? And in that searching, he's finding the answers. And I think it's a tale of such wonderful sacrifice. There's that wonderful scene, I don't know if you remember, where Bigwig, have you seen this and read it? He's decided that he is going to defend this rabbit hole from whatever is going to come at him, and he does. He's defending everybody, even until it's looking like he's going to die, he isn't going to give up. And I think that is the struggle that a lot of us have in life, isn't it? And in this song, we just get a glimpse. A very simple song, there's four or five chords. There's just a scrap of harmony, but it's stunningly beautiful.
Well, let's listen to a snatch of Bright Eyes sung here by Art Garfunkel.
You want to get a candle up, don't you? Get a candle.
Well, our next piece of music takes us back, 500 years or so, to a composer called Orlando Gibbons, a piece of music called CC, The Word is Incarnate, which in a few minutes our scratch choir will sing for us. But this also sort of links into the beginnings of your spiritual search as a child, and as you say, getting involved in the choir and so on. Tell us about that first time you went to the cathedral and heard the choir.
This is linking back to what I said at the very beginning. When I decided to go and seek out what this feeling was that I had, I went first to the local Anglican cathedral, which is the Cathedral of St. Asaph, as I walked in, the choir was singing this piece, CC, the Word is Incarnate, God is made man in the womb of a virgin, and by the great composer Orlando Gibbons. And I was bowled over by this line after line of polyphony, line after line of all these weaving lines. I saw something so magical in that, that I felt that was what I was supposed to be getting involved with. And so when I had this meeting with the dean of the cathedral, I said, actually, I've changed my mind. I know what I want to do now. I want to be in that choir. And he said, well, we don't just have anyone in that choir. He said, you'll have to audition. So anyway, I didn't. Luckily enough, I didn't have a voice of a foghorn at that age. And they let me in. And it was the start of getting involved in choral and vocal music. I have to say, it was an inauspicious start, because after I auditioned, the very first day of starting, as I was walking in, the choir master was being marched out by police. Enough about that. I think you can look that up on Google. I survived that, and so we were. It was a brilliant start, and I have to say, that there's nothing more brilliant for any person trying to find the meaning of life than through music or through the great utterances of music. Art in all of its forms enriches us in the most unbelievable way. Every lecture I do at the university begins with a poem. I take the composition students out to see contemporary dance, to see ballet. I think that it's important on all of us to look at how every human being that we can has touched the subject of immortality and life, and how we exist as people. And there's nothing more immediate than music, nothing more, something that touches you instantly. And you know what? The great thing about music is you don't have to speak the language.
So let us welcome onto another platform, George, to conduct our choir in singing CC, The Word is Incarnate by Orlando Gibbons.
It's an amazing piece. I don't know if you followed the words of that. If you could, they sang very well. It's an incredibly difficult piece to sing, by the way. Well done, everybody. That's very hard. But it's the New Testament in 7 minutes. But you wish sermons were like that. You know, you get everything you need. You get, you know, the child is born, the powers of hell are shaken as Christ dies and then is reborn in glorious ascension. It's all in there, everything you need to know in those 7 minutes. And I was, as a child, can you imagine? Just thrown into a wow, you know. And this has been sung for nearly 600 years, exactly as it should be, unchanged and unaltered for 600 years. That's what draws me to the church, that it is our past, our present, and our future, unchanging.
So, as a composer, you talked about reaching for the unknown and hopefully discovering it in time to meet your deadlines and so on. How literally, as a composer and artist, how literally or seriously do you take the ancient notion of artistic inspiration?
Yeah, it's a very good question, because, you know, at the end of the day, you have to write something. You can't wait for the muse to come, but I've discovered that actually, my grandmother once said to me, a lazy man finds time for nothing, a busy man will find time for everything. And I think it's the truth with inspiration, that the more you sit at the desk and work at a regular pace, the more inspiration is more likely to find you. And so That's how I kind of work. But there are some times, you know, I'm not Mozart. You know, Mozart could write an entire piece and know from the bass up, finishing off with the melody, as he did with the settings of the Requiem that he did. So I'm not like that, of course. Nobody ever has been since. But you can have ideas that mull over as you go to sleep and you wake up and a finished piece can be somewhere near there. There are different types of composers. There are like Beethoven, who painstakingly looked at every single note and you know, took him years to write the Ninth Symphony. I'm not like that, but I do believe fundamentally that there is this idea of divine inspiration as well. I'm completely convinced of that the more I live.
Mm. So tell us about our fifth piece of music, which is going to be by the composer John Rutter, well known for composing sacred music. And we're going to have a sort of Christmas carol, I suppose it is, from him called What Sweeter Music. But tell us a little bit about Rutter and this piece of music, why you've chosen it.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, John Rutter gets a bit of a bad press from certain corners of the choral world. And I don't quite know why, because he does what he does, and he does it well, and he never says he's going to do anything other than what he says he's going to do. And what strikes me about John's music, and I've come to know well over the last few years, it's the very first piece I sang as a choir boy. So I joined after the choir master was taken out. You're with me at that bit. A new choir master came in, and this was the piece that we started learning. And what struck me about it is it's instinctively beautiful. It's telling this wonderful tale of the power of music and so on. Instantly, John has an ability with his melodies to be original. I mean, there's lots of people who have copied him, but he was original to begin with. And it's a gorgeous, he has a gorgeous sense of pacing, of drama. And I think he's one of the great choral composers. And once you know, time has passed and we're able to look at him with fresh eyes, people will realise that. I was very fortunate to know Sir John Taverner, the great English composer who wrote the song for Athene, which was performed at Princess Diana's funeral. And Sir John never had a good review about his music in his life. He was much maligned by the critical press. And then the day of his death, every single man and his dog crawled out to say he was one of the greatest British composers that's ever lived. And Lady Taverner was furious because she said, I wish somebody had said this to him when he was alive. And so I think sometimes in Britain we neglect our legends until it's too late. And so I think John Rutter is without doubt one of the most important choral composers in the British choral history. And I wanted to include him for that reason.
Marvellous. So let us again have our scratch choir perform this piece for us. Thanks very much, guys. There you go. If the shops can start Christmas this early, why not the churches, hey? I mean, come on. So, let me advance my PowerPoint to make sure I know where I am in this. We've had Gibbons. Here we go. William Matthias. Yeah, I pronounced it wrong earlier. I pronounced it wrong again. Matthias. Who's someone you studied under in Wales. Tell us a little about William.
Yes, William Matthias, a very important composer in Wales and choral music. He was born in 1934, died in 1992. He had a very short life, he was only 57. But he was professor of music at the University of Bangor, and I grew up on Anglesey, so it's the closest university. And I had a very pushy grandmother, I think many of us do. I'm gathering a reaction here from people. And so she decided, when I decided I wanted to be a composer, you know, of all things, she said, well, I know a composer. So she went off to Will's house, knocked on his door, and said, my grandson's 9 and he wants to be a composer. You're going to teach him. So I kind of slightly maxed out because he just retired. He took early retirement due to ill health, and he was looking for a project. And so I became that project. And so I would turn up every fortnight with various harmony and counterpoint and polyphony and all this stuff, orchestration, and I'd sit in his conservatory overlooking the Menai Straits, a beautiful piece of land, writing music. And I learned so much from him, you know, over the years. And then, of course, he fell incredibly ill, and he was dying, and I think I was one of the last people to see him, and I was still quite young, and he loved a drink, Will. He really liked a glass of whatever was going. And when I went to see him at the end, he was in bed, and Yvonne said to me, "You haven't got to drink any alcohol, have you? He's not allowed any." I was about 12 or something. I said, no, I don't have any. So I go up into his bedroom, and I sit on his bed, and he goes, "Has she gone?" So I went to the room and had a look out. I go, "Yeah," and he pulls out a bottle of scotch. That was the kind of guy he was. And it's really interesting that, you know, we talk about, is someone their art? You know, and Oscar Wilde, of course, has taught us that, you know, humanity, you're not necessarily your art. You know, you can love Wagner but hate the man's politics. You don't have, they're not the same thing. Where in Will, that's not true. This music is him, full of life, full of wit, full of humour, and lively rhythms and cross rhythms. And the interesting fact to this, so in 1981, he wrote this piece we're going to hear now called "Let the People Praise Thee, O God," for the wedding of Prince Charles and Lady Diana Spencer. Little did any of us know that 30 years later, I'd be doing a similar thing for William and Catherine. So it's a little bit of stroke of, I don't know what, but I just thought it'd be nice to include this because he's always in my mind. And the interesting thing, whenever I write a note down, I always imagine him going, "Do you really mean that, boy?" So I think, no. And his favourite line was always, "I like it, but it's two bars too long." And I'd say, "Which two bars?" He goes, "Ah, then you'd be the teacher and I'd be the student."
Well, let's hear this YouTube clip of the Atlanta chorus singing "Let the People Praise Thee, O God."
He told a very funny story, actually, Will. There's a piece he wrote called "Sir Christmas." I don't know if any of you know that. You guys might know that. A Christmas carol. And at the end of it, you're supposed to shout, "Noel!" So he goes, da-da-da-da-da-da, "Noel!" Anyway, at the premiere at King's College, Cambridge, one guy was late, a baritone player, and they'd said to him, "We're going to shout sod off at the end." And he goes, "Really?" He goes, "Yeah, Will's here, and you know he loves a laugh and stuff, so we're going to do it just for Will." So it comes to this bit, and he goes, da-da-da-da-da-da, nobody does anything but this one guy, "Sod off!" He's quite a famous organist now.
Yeah. The next piece you've chosen is by Frédéric Chopin, his nocturne in C minor. Chopin. So there was a bit of a sort of family connection here, in a sense, that you were telling me about.
The C sharp minor. My father is Polish. Our name was originally Milarowski, and my grandmother and her sister-in-law and my father, the nine children that were my father's family, had to leave Krakow during the Second World War. My grandfather died in Auschwitz. He had to stay behind so that they could escape. And so there's that Polish, strong Polish connection that's been with me, particularly from my grandmother. My great-aunt Ethel, who lived till the age of 107, 1897 to 2004, and when I asked her how she'd lived so long, she goes, "If Hitler's not going to get me, God's not having me either." And she lived on cigarettes and booze, a great example of what not to do to live to 107. But what struck me is that through talking with her and indeed my grandmother, what I hadn't realized is in all my choral music, there's this low stuff in deep fifths and thirds. And I remember my great aunt was saying, "Don't you think this is our kind of the Russian-Polish heritage?" Because Milarowski is a Russian name of the Russian Orthodox Church, which she'd always have playing as I was growing up. So I just wonder whether that's there. But I was drawn to Chopin, one of the greatest Polish composers, next to Penderecki and Gorecki and Lutosławski. And there you go. I was drawn to it, particularly the nocturne in C sharp, because it's minor, because it's now connected through various performances and various films to the Second World War. It's that famous story of that wonderful young Polish pianist who was kept alive in the concentration camps because she could play it, and the commandant kept making her play. And then there's, you know, that famous The Pianist, a Spellman, where that this nocturne. So it's become synonymous with that period, although it wasn't published in Chopin's lifetime. It was published 25 years after his death. And it's a phenomenal piece, which is incredibly moving.
And here is the beginning of this piece played by pianist Tiffany Poon. And our final piece of music is Ubi Caritas from The Royal Wedding. But this is, in a sense, a piece that you had written and then rewrote in a different context. Fill us in how that came about.
Yes, well, I was sitting at my desk in the university marking first-year harmony papers. Not a task I enjoy, I can tell you that, for nothing. Everyone was failing as I was going through. And then I get a phone call, and I pick it up, and the person says, you know, this is William Wales here. I'd like to speak with Paul Mueller. And I said, I don't know anybody called William Wales. And he goes, some people call me Prince William. So I said, oh, right, again. He said, Catherine has heard some of your music at St. Andrew's University Chapel Choir singing, and we'd like to include it in our wedding. Now, at this point, the wedding hadn't been announced, and I thought somebody was winding me up. I thought sooner or later someone's going to burst in the door and say, ah. So I just agreed, yeah, okay, that's fine. And anyway, a few weeks later, a note comes, this letter, on Her Majesty's service, and it's the private secretary, Jamie Lowe, the Pinkerton, had written this thing, and then next to it was a thing with MI5 that I had to sign to say I wouldn't say anything until it was announced. So I thought, oh, it's actually true, this. But I had to get it witnessed. So the guy walking past at the time was a friend of mine called Alistair MacDonald, so I dragged him into the office, and I said, will you witness this? But the great thing is, he witnessed it, but he could say whatever he wanted. He didn't have to sign. So I mean, the kind of typical British kind of, you know. So he signed that. So anyway, so what it was is that the piece that I'd written was called A Setting of Now Sleeps the Crimson Petal, which is by Alfred Tennyson. There's a road not far from here called Tennyson Road, I noticed the other day, I'm sure. Anyway, so that was the setting that I'd done. And it went off, and everything agreed. And then I went for a meeting at Westminster Abbey, and the Dean of Westminster at the time, still is, Dr. John Hall, lovely man, he said, well, I'm not quite sure a song about two lovers lying naked in other's arms, sung at the wedding of the future King William V, is going to go down too well amongst some members of the population. So we agreed that maybe it wasn't. Although I have to say, the Song of Solomon is much more raunchy than that. Anyway, Song of Songs, sorry, much more raunchy than that. Anyway, so I decided that I would reset it musically, and that the words that I'd always wanted to set, and was thinking about setting later, was the Ubi Caritas. Where there is charity and love, God is there. And what struck me about those words, particularly in terms of this service, was that Catherine, later Duchess of Cambridge, she was actually making a pledge at that wedding to serve for the first time. So she'd come to serve, not be served, was what the pledge that was being made. And so I thought that this, the Ubi Caritas, which is normally sung at the washing of the feet on Monday, Thursday, would be exactly the right thing. Anyway, so I had a day to reset it. And I don't know about these guys, will know, musicians in the room will know how difficult it is to change the scansion of a poem to fit the music. I was having nightmares about this. I cancelled all my lectures. No complaints by the students. And I had to rewrite it all. And what I decided is, look, if you're going to deal with the Ubi Caritas text as a composer, there is one great big elephant in the room, and that is the composer Maurice Durufle, who has done the most famous setting of that. And a beautiful setting it is. He just takes the plain chant, Ubi Caritas et amor Deus Ibias, and then harmonizes it, and that's it. It's very simple and very beautiful. So I thought, well, I'm going to have to deal with Durufle here, just as if when you're writing a symphony, you have to deal with Haydn and Mozart and Beethoven and Sibelius and all these people. And so I thought what I would do is, I'm not going to ignore him, I'm going to put him in it. So let's take the plain chant as a little doffing of my cap to Mr. Durufle, Monsieur Durufle, and I thought at the very end I would have a quote from the original plain chant which Durufle uses. And because in our meetings, Catherine had told me she particularly loves the sound of a solo boy singing, a solo treble. There's nothing more powerful in a big cathedral than to hear one little boy sing a solo. It's very powerful. And so at the very end of my setting, this one little boy has to come forward and sing, just that one little line. And so it was great because they all learnt it on the day. And then literally on the day, James O'Donnell picks one little guy and says, "You're doing it." And his name was Thomas Featherstone Ho, I still remember it. And he goes, "Yeah, all right." Stands up, no fear at all, and goes out in front of 2.5 billion people and sings it. And did a great job of it. Didn't crack a note, didn't nothing. And so straight after this, at the wedding, I get 70,000 emails from people all over the world. I get letters. People stop me in the street. I mean, most people from America or from Australia who'd never heard Latin before. It's the only piece in the service that's Latin. And I get one letter which really affected me, and it was from a young guy in Texas. It was a few weeks later, maybe a month later. And he writes to me to say, one morning I had a rope around my neck and I was about to end it, and I heard this music coming from somewhere. He said, I took the rope from around my neck to find out what it was. He said, and it was your piece, Ubi Caritas. And I wanted to write to you to say that one act of stopping and to find out what the music was has saved my life. And so you have never know who's listening. It's like when you're preaching a sermon or you're meeting someone. You have no idea what state that person is in when you meet them or when they listen or when you perform. And it's important to always try and do your best and to be aware of that. My dad, who's a bit of a joker, said, you better not let him hear any more music or he'll put the rope back round. So luckily he did buy the CD and he was fine. But I suppose I suppose that the couple of points that I'm trying to make in this, when you asked me to come and talk about faith and music, we decided to do this slightly more unusual thing so that you'd actually hear music rather than just me talking about it. You know, there's that wonderful line, is that you'll learn more in singing the Psalms than from any sermon. And I think there's a bit of truth in that. You'll learn more from listening to the great masters of music, some of whom we've heard tonight, Chopin, you know, one of them, Gibbons, another. And I think John Rutter, another. By listening to this music, you really do hear the voice of God coming through in the most profound ways. And for me, what my journey has been as a Christian has been to navigate between my own wants to do as a composer and what God is asking me to do as a composer. And that's not always easy. And so trying to keep the message simple without being simplistic so that it can connect. There's no point in writing great, intense, complex works that don't connect to people. Because your job is as an evangelist if you are a writer of sacred music, which is why the great writers of sacred music are able to do that in great ways. So my mission is to find that still small voice of calm and to try and bring that as stupidly and as badly as my skills allow me, but nevertheless to try to do that so that when people sit and listen to this music, something of the beauty that I felt as a child, the warmth, comes through to them.
Well, let's listen to the opening of Ubi Caritas from the broadcast of that service itself. You can no doubt find this later on YouTube yourself and hear the choir boy at the end as well. So it comes to that stage where we tell you that on your desert island, you will, of course, have rescued from the shipwreck a copy of the complete works of Shakespeare and the Bible in your favourite translation. But you get to rescue one other book on your life raft, as it were. So what book would you choose to have on the island with you?
That's like the worst nightmare. I mean, I read poetry all the time, as I was telling you, and I love fantasy as well. My nephew's in Game of Thrones. You know, do you watch that, Game of Thrones? So he sends me all the scripts of a little bit beforehand. Don't tell anybody. So I love all that stuff. And then luck. the two writers that I'm going to cheat if I can. The two writers that I think mean so much to me in terms of if I'm going to be on that island, I'm going to need a bit of escapism. And it's C.S. Lewis and, of course, J.R.R. Tolkien. I think with the complete works of Lewis and Tolkien, I could be pretty happy for a while.
Pretty thick,
really. I've dragged a lot off that boat, haven't I?
Perhaps it's on a Kindle these days.
But I just think, you know, with Lewis, with those wonderful Narnia tales, and then with the Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit and Silmarillion. I love the way the Silmarillion begins, you know, and then Tolkien uses it later on. Lewis uses it later on. It begins through music. You know, Ilúvatar breathes in musical notes, and then harmony comes from that. And I just love all of that. And, of course, the Hindu texts are similar. So I couldn't do without those. And I could just find out a little bit more of the Witch King of Angmar, and I could find out a little bit more about Galadriel and do all that stuff, which I don't have time to do. I'm afraid, if I'm allowed, I'd like to take those.
Yeah. And traditionally, you are allowed one luxury item as well. And, of course, the most chosen item is a piano.
That's right.
So would you like a piano with
you
on the island?
No, it would drive me mad. I think the thing that would... I mean, I get very annoyed. I have a place right on the sea, and I have a piano there. And literally, I get it tuned by this guy, and literally within 10 minutes, it's out of tune. And it drives me mad. He's tuning it every week. I couldn't be doing that. So I think if I'm allowed, I'll cheat again. And I have one real sin, and that's I really love gin and tonic. So I think I would have an endless supply of gin and tonic with ice and lime.
And if you were forced to choose just one of our eight pieces of music that we've heard this evening, which would you rescue as the ship was going down?
I think it would be the Gibbons. I think the interesting thing about Orlando Gibbons is it's music that never grows old. Of course, stylistically, the world changes, but the music, the language, never grows old. Glenn Gould, you know, the great American pianist, he was asked by NASA, they were sending up a pod into space to represent the human race, should an alien ever find this. These things in this pod would represent the very best of the human race. So Shakespeare is in there and all that. Glenn Gould has asked what piece of music would go in there, and he picked Gibbons, Orlando Gibbons. So, you know, when Alien Zod, or whatever it is, discovers this stuff, the greatest thing in there that he'll find to represent us is the music of Orlando Gibbons. And I think it's stunning music, and it's music just like Tallis and Tompkins and Bird and all of these composers of the Tudor Elizabethan period. First Elizabethan period. It's stunning the music.
Well, I've had my opportunity to ask you some questions, but this is something we wouldn't get to do if this were on radio, to give the audience an opportunity to ask some questions. So Keith Fox over here has a microphone which he's going to set up in the aisle here. And if you would like to ask Paul a question and think, why didn't Peter ask him that? Well, here's your opportunity. Come up to the microphone. We've got 10 minutes or so in which we can ask some questions before we finish and have some refreshments at the back there. Anyone want to be brave, stand up, come and ask us a question of Paul?
Embarrassing moments when nobody gets up.
Oh, yeah. Marvellous. You can just come and join the queue. And thank you.
How do you get over the fear of the blank page?
Oh, that's a very good question. It's the same with any writer, isn't it? You know, whether it's composition or whether it is literature or poetry or whatever you do, dance or these things, you have to plan it out. I think the most important thing is to plan. Is not just to allow, just to sit there and think that the muse is going to come to you. You have to go to it. And to plan. And the more you can plan off and section off the page, the less it looks scary. One of my students always say to me, how do you start a piece? That's the most important. How do you start? And I always say, well, starting a piece of music is just like starting a novel. You have to ask a question, which then the novel answers. So, for example, you take The Hobbit. I've got it already, so you can't have it. In a hole in the ground there lives a hobbit. Why is that the best opening line? What on earth is a hobbit? And what's it doing living in a hole in the ground? And so the rest of the book then answers all those questions and puts that in context. So when you start writing a piece of music, the minute you put an interval next to each other, it has implications, it has questions, it has stuff that you then have to try and work out. So that's how I try to look at it. Different composers do different things, but it is terrifying. Not to let it terrify you is another thing. It's like with any nerves, isn't it? The more you do, the less nervous you get at it, and the less worried you are at it. But it's a very good question. Any useful? Is that any use to you? Yeah.
There seems to be a general decline in popular music since the 60s and 70s, when you had a great deal of richness. How would you go about addressing that and bringing more diverse music to the masses?
You mean, what do you mean by popular music? Do you mean?
I mean like chart music, for instance. Oh. But just generally, there seems to be less diversity in music than when I was growing up. What are your opinions on that?
Yeah, I disagree, because I mean, I think every, I mean, you're probably the same age as me, I think, and I think every person who gets around our age or similar thinks that, and thinks, oh, the music today is a load of nonsense, you know. But I think there's amazing stuff being written now, you know. I hate Sam Smith and people like that, but it's not bad music. It's good music. And so, you know, on my very first album, I hesitate to say this in church, but it's true, was Run to the Hills by Iron Maiden, because I was fascinated by the rhythms. But there is still music being written like that now. There is still music. We just don't know about it. It's being hidden, you know. My nieces and nephew, years ago, went to go to these raves and stuff, and I went to pick them up. And I said, what is that? This amazing sound, which I didn't know about. And there's all this acid rock and all this kind of stuff. I think there's loads of good stuff. It's just that the BBC chooses not to broadcast it. It's like Cliff Richard. He never gets broadcast, but he's not bad. Disagreement in the back.
I just wondered, I don't know if you may have done it already, but I just wondered, would you consider composing for the general congregation to be able to sing? Obviously, the things that you compose are more complicated and for more specialists.
There are a couple of it's a good question. There are a couple of answers to that. Firstly, when in my slightly younger days, my publisher said, "Oh, you know, if you made this slightly easier, more choirs could do it." I said, "I don't want more choirs doing it. I want the best choirs doing it." That's why I did it like that. I'm not in this to make money. I'm in this to make a statement. But having said that, recently I have been thinking about it. That there are good choirs that don't have the divisi, the numbers that you need necessarily to do these pieces that I do. And so I have written a number of things for trebles and organ for St. Marylebone Parish Church in London. They've commissioned a number of pieces. And I have made a very simplified version of what I would normally do, and I've actually been pretty happy with it. So it's kind of simplification without selling out. That means. Well, I can't sell out because I never brought in, but if you know what I mean. But it's an interesting point and something I have been thinking about. In terms of writing congregational hymns, well, it would depend which congregation. I don't really write for guitars and tambourines and stuff like that. It's not my thing. I'm not against it. It's just not my thing. But if somebody wanted a classical, a lighter song, then I'd be very happy to do that. And I've been commissioned by a big American church to do such a thing, which I'm doing at the moment. In terms of selling out, I should tell you who I'm going to see in December. So 4 years ago, I was commissioned to write a Christmas carol for the lighting of the Christmas trees in Washington. And so I agreed to do it. We were laughing about this yesterday. And so I wrote the piece, sent it off. And then, I forgot that the president is going to be there. Trump that one.
Anyone else? Yes, thank you.
Just thinking back to John Rutter and his comment that, because he writes some very, his music is brilliant, often on spiritual themes, but he says he suspends his disbelief while he's writing. How do you respond to that, and how does that affect the way he writes music compared to the way you write music?
No, I think it's a very good point, and John is an atheist, and I think he's quite open about it. But I think he kind of had a difficult time when his son died. His son was killed outside Clare College, Cambridge, was knocked over. And I think that really affected John in many ways. And I think maybe at that point, I don't know, but at that point he had a problem with faith. I mean, that comes understandable, isn't it? But I think, yes, I mean, of course you can disband disbelief, can't you, in anything. If you go to see a Bertolt Brecht play, you suddenly don't become a communist. You know, it's like you go and listen to the St. Matthew Passion by Bach, you don't suddenly become a Christian. So I think you can do that. For me, I find there must be, and I'm not a philosopher, but there must be some difference, and I don't know what it is, between someone who's writing something who doesn't fully believe in it and someone who is writing something who fully believes in it. I don't know if that can be proved or indeed, if in fact, if that's a point, but I feel in my heart that there is a point in that. I don't know what it is, but I do think that there is something. Just like, you know, like reading a translation. If you want to read the great Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard, you can read it in English, but there are words in Danish that don't translate in English, so you miss something. So I just wonder whether that's the same.
Last askings? No? Yep, one more.
I was really interested in your near-death experience or your... Could you say a little bit more about it? And perhaps, I think you said about not feeling afraid or something like that. Could you say how that may have been formative?
Yes, it's very interesting. Whenever I mention this, and I don't mention it that often, but whenever I do mention it, there's always people that talk to me afterwards who've had very similar experiences or know someone. So I don't think this is an unusual thing. I think people are afraid to talk about it. You know, let's face it, people are afraid to talk about Christianity. I've got so much stick on social media for being a Christian, which I would never have had if I was a Muslim or a Hindu or an atheist. All people feel they can say anything, you know, which is terrible. But it's even worse when I say I've had a near-death experience. Then, oh, I've ticked all the baddies, haven't I? Royal family, and Jesus, and near-death. I'm damned, you know. But I think, for me, what happened is... and you've got to remember, I was 9 at the time, so I may have reformulated this through the years... When I fell into the water, you're kicking and pulling, and water is an amazing thing because you're dragging yourself down, really. The water isn't doing anything. And so I'm eventually realize I can't get out of this, and I say, well, this is it. And at that moment, I felt tingling all the way through my body. I felt a great warmth that was not just around me because I was cold at that point, but also inside. And if I had closed my eyes, I would have died and would not have been unhappy. That was the feeling that I had. I didn't see a great light or anything like that, but I did feel that there was something else and that this wasn't the end. No one spoke, or I didn't hear any words or anything, or tunnel, which a lot of people see. I didn't have any of that. But I did know that that wasn't the end. And if I hadn't have been dragged out, I would have closed my eyes at that point. And it has been incredibly informative because it's that warmth. And a lot of people say about my music that it's warm. And that's what I've been trying to do over 25 years, is to create warmth in sound, because to try and recapture that warmth that happened at that point.
Thank you. Thank you.